Welcome to the RPG Design Panelcast, presenting the very best recorded panels and seminars about game design and publishing. These panels have been made possible thanks to the kind contributions of the panel speakers at Metatopia 2023. Episode 370, 10 Things Wrong With Your Game, presented by Sydney Engelstein and Jeff Engelstein.
Now you're turning to me?
Oh no, I can talk.
Hi everybody! Thank you so much for coming!
Yes, so this is Top 10 Things Wrong With Your Game. We'll introduce ourselves, but for anybody that knows me, I certainly will talk pretty much endlessly unless I am stopped. So we're very open for questions. We'd like it to be interactive. So if anybody wants to ask a question, you know, just raise your hand or shout out or whatever, and we're happy to stop and answer that for you. So feel free to, you know, point out anything that you would like to. So first we'd like to introduce ourselves.
I'm Sydney Engelstein. I am currently the Director of Game Development at Indie Game Studios, which means I get to work on designs and development of projects that we pick up in-house. And additionally, something that I think gives me a lot of insight into games is I'm the head of acquisitions for our company, which means I come to conventions like this, and I play people's board games to see if they would be a good fit to be picked up by our company and produced by us. So I have been pitched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games and looked at them, and so I know a lot of sort of common pitfalls that people will stumble into, especially with early designs or designs that they've been working on for a very long time, and it's hard to get, you know, your mind out of something you've been working on for a very long time, take a step back and see. So that's sort of what I'm going to bring to this panel.
Okay. And I am Jeff Engelstein, so I have several games designed, my most recent being the Super School Pinball series. I did the Expanse games. I've also written a number of books on game design, including Building Blocks, which is up there. And I teach game design. I've taught game design at NYU for the last 7 years or so. So I also have seen a lot of student games. I mean, they're not games necessarily trying to be published, but certainly have evaluated a lot of games and seen things that have come out. So that's our background. We would like to, the inspiration for this came from designer Sen Phum Lim, who did Junk Art and Shang-Chi and Mind Management. He's done a lot of stuff, and he posted on Twitter, "Your board game critique," which is things I'd probably tell you if I play tested your game. And I thought that was a very clever way of phrasing it, because there definitely are things that are
very common, overlapping in a lot of games. So if you've already seen this list, this will be maybe a little bit of a deeper dive into what he meant by these bullet points.
Okay. We also, in traditional top 10 list fashion, are starting with number 10 and going down to number 1, mm-hmm. but they are not ranked in order of importance or commonality or anything like that. So I think the first one actually is probably the most common one that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Number 10, there's too much going on in your game. I find that this is especially one that first-time designers will fall into, because usually someone who's very excited about getting into board game design has been thinking about their board game for a long time and has tons of ideas in their head of what kind of board games they would want to make. So when they sit down to make a board game, they put every idea they've ever had into that board game. They think, oh, I've always wanted to make a deck builder and a worker placement, and, you know, and on and on and on. And so their game feels distracted. It goes in too many different directions. There's no feeling of, this is the core of the game experience that I want the player to have. It's muddied by having too many systems.
Right. Yeah, we actually, when we're talking amongst ourselves, we call it first time gamer designer itis. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is the most common thing that we see. It's just that, and as she said, just throwing everything and the kitchen sink into the game. You're going to be able to design a second game. A lot of people just feel like this is it. This is their one shot. They better get their best ideas in there. So each of these things we're going to illustrate with a game.
That we designed. Just to let you know, we are not above you. We've made all these mistakes.
So this is Space Cadets. So Space Cadets, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it came out like 2012. So this was actually my second game.
My first game.
So this is a cooperative game where you are the crew of a non-copyright infringing starship trying to do missions. And you each have little mini games that you play. So you're all kind of working together and it's real time. So every 30 seconds you have to do something, load the torpedo tubes or set up the shields or whatever, and everyone's got an officer role. You know, I'm immensely proud of this game. I was actually thinking we should go back. It's been a while since I've played it. But it's actually got like 10 different mini games that all affect each other and all can be scaled for difficulty and all you can add energy to them, which makes things easier or harder. There's a lot of stuff going on. But it's a terrible game to teach because you have to teach like 10 different games.
Yeah, and if you heard the concept in your head of Mario Party mini games that are like dexterity and fun and fast, you might be thinking, wow, what a great game for families and children and a party game, which it would be if it didn't have so much going on that it's like really impossible to get through the rule book and to explain to people before they start kind of wandering away because yeah. They're overwhelmed by just the quantity of stuff in the game.
But people that love it really love it.
Yeah, it's, and again, a game that has too much going on is not necessarily a bad game, but it could be a better game if it sort of synthesized down to exactly what it's trying to do, and you make sure that you put all your effort into getting that mechanic to shine instead of dividing it amongst many mechanics and then not being able to give it the sort of attention that it deserves.
Okay. Number 9. Your game is too long. Even if your game is short, it's probably too long. I would rather play your game twice, a shorter game twice, than play a longer game once. The example game we have for this, as mentioned, I did the Super Skill Pinball Series, which is a roll and write pinball game, and that was the number one critique of it when it came out. People loved it, but they were like, boy, it really outstays its welcome. And honestly, I was tied to kind of the pinball metaphor. It's actually played in rounds. And it probably would have been better at like one or two rounds, but I put in three rounds because in pinball, you get three rounds. And that's, my gosh, that's what the game was going to be. It also, you know, really it scaled in an interesting way with more than one player. Even though it was simultaneous play, it still felt like it took longer with four players versus one player. And, you know, this is like a 20-minute, it should be like a 20 to 30-minute experience. It was clocking in at like 30 to 40. And I even heard of some groups that, look, took a really long time that were going upwards of an hour. And it's just, you know, there's many games that 45 minutes to an hour is fine. This game, just the nature of the experience did not support it. Wherever possible, you really should look for ways to take time out of your game. The other thing which is really hard to get past, which is why it's very useful to come to conventions like this, is that it's very hard to judge your own game in terms of how long it takes to play.
Because you'll play it a lot faster than anybody else will play it.
Yeah, right. I mean, even like, you know, Space Cadets or other games, you know, when I played this, you know, I could rip through a game in 20 minutes, easy. And then, you know, to watch other people play it, it's just very instructive and informative to, you know, the extra time that it's going to take when somebody else does it. So wherever possible, look to take it out. We just tested it again.
In an extemporaneous anecdote, on the drive here this morning, we looked at each other and said we had a high test of a prototype we brought here last night. And we went, well, we sort of were very inspired by this game, Magical Athlete, to make the game. And that game has like three races in it. So our game has three races. Maybe it should be two races. Why did we do three races? We just sort of left that in from so long. So now that's something we're considering since this is one of our own bullet points. But I think another thing you have to consider with your game being too long is the importance of the first play experience, especially in the hobby market. Gamers have so many games on their shelves, you can't expect your game to get more than one play before people will make their opinion on it. So you need to make sure their first play experience is super fun, super engaging, and exactly what you want it to be. And having a long game where you're thinking, oh, people won't fully grok the strategy on their first play, but when they play it their second time, they'll look through and realize they made these mistakes. The longer the game is, while people aren't fully engaged in what the game is trying to do, the less likely they are to come back around a second time and be like, okay, now I know what I'm getting into. If you have, say, a 30-minute game, and you play and you're like, oh man, on turn two, I didn't realize the importance of this card. Let's just do it again really fast. But if you play a 2-hour game and people feel like, man, this needs a second playthrough before I really understand it, you're a lot less likely to get people sitting down for that and enjoying themselves enough to come back around and play your game.
Yeah.
So, say you go to a game store, you see a box that says, you know, this game takes 30 minutes for two players.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you expect that to take for somebody their first time? Would you expect it to take 40 minutes?
Well, usually, so one thing about the time on the box is it does not include rules reading.
Yeah.
So with rules reading and then slowed down, like checking rules as you play, figuring out the decisions you want. Did your computer just die?
No, I just switched it to only show here to try to save a little bit.
Figuring out what they should be doing and the decisions they should be making and cross-checking things. I'd say it'll take maybe 25 to 30% longer than is listed on the box. And also it's incredibly group dependent, which obviously you can't control for, but anywhere you can take out the opportunity for AP to get involved, for any parts where one player has to, you know, think of something and everybody else has nothing to do during that period of time, anything like that that you can remove will make a better play experience because people will be engaging with the game a lot more frequently.
And everybody lies on their box about how long their game takes. It's the optimal time.
There are also, you know, there are certain quantities of time you can put on a box. We don't really go outside of 15-minute windows, for example. Nobody puts an hour in 15 minutes. It would be an hour would be what gets put on the box, or 90 minutes would be what gets put on the box. And we usually, at my company, when we try and think of play times, we think, how long do we take to play? And then add a little bit to it. But we've definitely gotten some reports from people who are like, that time on the box is not true. My group plays it way longer.
Oh, yeah.
What about, say, you have a game that's for 2 to 4 players. Would you have, like, the average time for 2 players, and that's, like, the 60-minute game, and then the 90-minute game?
Sometimes boxes will say, like, per player, if it mm-hmm. really matters. Yeah. I mean, if it's, sometimes they'll say, like, 30 minutes per player.
I don't tend to love when things scale that much per player because I feel like it doesn't. So this is more from a marketing perspective as someone who works at a board game company. When a game has that wildly diverging amounts of time based on the player count, it means it isn't appealing sort of to one singular audience. Because if we make a short game that's 15 minutes long, we know, you know, we want to get it to the light market, the family market, party market, maybe in Target, something like that. And if we have a game that's an hour long, we're not going to Target, we're not going to the family market, we're going to more a hardcore gamer. And if you give us a game that's trying to be both, or, you know, is really fast and really slow, it's harder to figure out what type of art style should it have. Should it be serious? Should it be funny? You know, because those kinds of considerations, all the way down to like what size of box and price point, depend on the length of time that the game takes. You wouldn't pay $60 for a 20-minute game, but you might for an hour game because it's a longer experience. So having a really wide gulf of how long your game takes, depending on what version of the game you're playing or how many players you have, can be a little tricky of a sell.
Okay. You want to do number 8? Should I?
Oh, what is number 8? Number 8! You don't reward the fun. So our game up there was our third game?
No.
Fourth game?
No.
Well, okay, maybe you should say.
I don't know. It's like at least 5th. I can think of 4 before. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Our game, Dragon and Flaggin. It is a move programming game, sort of like Robo Rally, where everyone plays a fantasy character getting into a big brawl in a tavern. And so you're pre-programming like punches and kicks and special magic things and trying to make sure they land on other people who are all moving in different ways. And we put this one up for this because it takes a very long time to get to the center and actually land hits on other people and achieve your special combos. Oh, is that not why you put it up?
That's not why I put it there.
Oh. I recommended this game personally because I feel like the fun of the game is getting your special combos to go off, and the size of the board and the complexity of figuring out when you should plot
Yeah, I mean, just in general, it's a barroom brawl, and each character has a deck of cards that are their moves, and there's some basic moves that everybody's got, but every character also has crazy special moves.
Right. And
you have a super ultimate move, which is if you get to the middle and grab the flagon and drink from it, then you get your super powerful special move.
Every movement takes a certain amount of time. There's no turns. Instead, if you turn over, you know, a walk, that's a very basic move that just moves you up one time, whereas a super dragon kick might move you four times, so then you don't get to act until the timer reaches you again. And people would spend far more of the game walking and repositioning themselves to get near to other players than actually feeling like I'm a super fantasy character who gets to throw out my really cool kicks and punches and magic, because of the fact that those things are so much higher investment, more dangerous to do, because if they miss, you're screwed. Why did you put it on this number?
Well, I mean, it's kind of related. We wanted, what we found was that most people were playing with the basic kind of core actions. They weren't doing their special actions because they were a little bit trickier to land. And you get reputation points when you never like cause damage or knock somebody out. You take their reputation away from them when you score a hit on them. So it's like a closed economy from that standpoint. But what we found was that people weren't doing the fancier moves. It was just, if you could just like walk to somebody and push them, that was really easy. Whereas swinging off a table and kicking somebody in the head while you were going over them or setting
the cinematic
up some crazy, right.
The things that would tell a good story.
The things we wanted people to do. So we basically, even though mathematically it doesn't make any sense, is we like doubled basically all the rewards that you got for the moves we wanted people to do. You know, even though I knew I'm a math guy, I knew mathematically it was way overpriced. You're getting way too much benefit from that, and it was really devaluing the other stuff. But that's what we wanted people to do, so we incentivized them to do it. So we basically just said balance be damned. That's what we're going to do, and it really got to the place where we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
People looking at this, I can get 10 reputation by doing this. I only get one if I push the person. I'm going to try to make this happen. And they spent the extra effort to do it.
A lot of people come into board games from a nerdy background. We got a lot of math people, a lot of engineers, a lot of magic players, poker players, all that kind of stuff that really rewards hyper-balance numbers, you know? But especially when you're at a playtesting convention like this, one of the things that's really helpful to get from your playtesters is if somebody, you know, pulls up a card and says, this is underpowered, and you look at it, you do the math, you go, that card's exactly right. There's still a reason people might be calling it underpowered, because it's about player perception and player experience is more important than the actual mechanics of your game, unless you're doing like a themeless two-player abstract strategy game like chess, where everything is 100% exactly in line, then you want the players to feel like the cards they're playing are having impacts. If they feel like a card is underpowered, then it's not getting played, and then why is it in the game? Everything has to kind of be more about making your game feel like the experience you want your players to have and the fun you want your players to have than making it exactly what the card should be according to spreadsheets.
Right. Perceived balance is way more important than actual balance. I used to be like usually an actual balance. The more I realize it doesn't. It doesn't matter. No one's playing, for reals, no one's playing your game 20 times. Somebody buys your game, they're going to play it three or four times.
I designed for a series called Aeon's End. It's a cooperative deck building game, and we are currently working on the 8th main game box for it. So there's been 7 games, and each game comes with 2 small expansions. So basically what I'm saying is there's been a ton of Aeon's End content. So having to come up with new characters, new market cards, we're sort of, you know, having to really be creative to come up with new things. And the audience is definitely like, hey, there's been power creep. Things are stronger than they used to be. And that's a little bit on purpose, because when we have a card that we look at previous cards we've designed, you know, we designed a card that does 2 damage in this effect, we designed a card that does 4 damage, or that does 3 damage in this effect, we can have 2.5 in between them. So we always err on the side of stronger, because we want people to feel like they're powerful. We want people to feel like stuff is cool and they want to buy it from the market. So we'll always, if we're stuck between, it should probably be a little weaker than this, but a little stronger than this, we'll always make it the stronger side.
Yeah.
Just for player experience and feeling like, oh, I got this new set and this mage is so cool. It can do this crazy stuff. And I get to have that moment where I feel amazing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're designing a game, playtesting game here, actually, mm-hmm. which is where you it's a, it was that race game we just talked about. We're going to 3 races, 2 races. But every single racer has a special ability. And we wanted every ability to for you to look at it and say, oh, my God, this is broken.
Yeah, we want every single person every single going into the race, they put it down, they go, I'm going to win this race, no problem. And then everyone turns theirs up. They're like, oh, my God, your guys' are also amazing.
Okay, let's move along.
Yeah.
Before we run out of power.
Uh-oh.
We ran out of power.
We ran out of power. Do you remember what number 7 was?
I do not. Okay. I think number 7 was your rules are too complicated.
Okay.
We're sorry. I charge this up at home where I came, and I was like, something happened that's like not holding a charge. I don't know what's going on. I bring it. So, what was that? It's an HP. It's a newer machine, but it's something weird's been going on with the battery lately. I should have brought do you have a power supply? Oh, wow.
Oh, no. Our wow. Hero.
It works.
Is there an outlet around here?
Yeah, there's a cord right here.
Let's see if that end. I'm sorry. This is the one you put it
on. Yeah, no, it's got to be plugged into, right? Yeah. Just, does it have a little thing on it?
No, it has...
Well, I mean, does it say what it is?
Oh, yeah, it's...
Oh, yeah, this should be fine.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Wow.
Okay. 300 watt, 19.5 volt, 6.5 amps.
I'm going to stand back and the computer's going to explode.
Oh, jeez.
you want to talk about why rules are too complicated?
Yeah, so let's talk this. Rules. So this is very related to, obviously...
Thank you so much.
We're going to kind of overlap in some of these points. And so this one is similar to your game is too long. And again, talking about first play experience. Players can't have their first play experience until they've read the rule book and understand how to play. And if players take your rule book out of your game and feel intimidated by them or confused by them, they're not even going to play your game for the first time. They're not going to give it a chance. Even if they...
We'll keep talking about it.
Well, we'll go back to that one.
That's really funny.
If your rules are so long and complicated that they make mistakes, forget certain rules, things get overlooked because of the quantity of information you're imparting to them, they're not going to play correctly and could have, again, a very bad first play experience because they feel like, oh, well, the game is so broken, it doesn't even do this, it doesn't do that. Then they won't want to play again because they'll think, just a poorly designed game. And so making sure your rules are clear, accessible, and not overwhelming will just make your game more enjoyable for players than games that overwhelm you with rules will be.
So, yeah, the game that's going to be up there in a few slides is my very first game, the Ares Project, which, again, I'm immensely proud of. It's a 2-4-player game that's supposed to be like StarCraft, where there's different factions fighting each other. But it was the first game I did, and when it came time to write the rules, I felt, I was like, this is not going to be a problem. I was had programmed computers since 1981, maybe. And I'm like, a computer program is a series of instructions that is how to accomplish a task. And I'm like, I can just break down what this game is supposed to be and explain it step by step of what it is. I've done this a zillion times. It's not going to be a problem. And I wrote the rule book, and it was basically incomprehensible. It was comprehensible to me, but it's incomprehensible to everybody else. And it's partially that your rules, the rules of the game may be complicated, but also just in general, a rules document is really tough to write well.
It's a skill to be able to write a good rules document.
The rules are trying to do two different things at the same time. So one is they're trying to, there's rules as instruction, and there's rules as rules as reference. So they're trying to do two. So the first thing they're trying to do is explain to you how to play the game. Okay, and I'm sure some of us have done this where you actually sit in a group and you read the rules out loud. It's a terrible way to teach the game, right? I mean, if you internalize the rules and you've played it, you teach it in a totally different way than the way that they're in the rules. And so that's one way that you need. And the other way is rules as reference, which is like if you come back to a game after 2 years and you want to play it, you need to very quickly be able to tell, oh, what does this power do, or what does this card do,
or mid-game.
Or mid-game,
you
want
to look
up
a rule.
Up, right?
They should know where to find it in the rule book, and they should be able to flip to it quickly and have it be where they expect it to be and also be concisely laid out so they can notice it quickly.
So it's really, really hard for one document to do both of those things. So actually, Fantasy Flight, I think they may still do this. I mean, they split it up, right? They would have, like, start here, learn to play book. And then there would be their rules reference book as a separate thing. I know, like, Twilight Imperium had that, and Descent had that, and some other things did that, right? So that's explicitly just trying to do that. Some people try to do it through videos. You know, I've even seen some where they teach it, like, you know, the first Through the Ages did it terribly because it had, like, three different games that you could play, which was good for learning, but it was terrible as a reference because when you wanted to look a rule up, you didn't know where it was. It could be anywhere in the book because they had an intro game and an advanced game and an expert game, full game. And it was like the rules were only in one of those three spots, but you didn't know when they introduced it, right? So you just got to also really think about the organization of your rules, particularly for a more complicated game of how am I going to teach it versus how am I going to provide a reference to players later.
And while you're here at the prototype convention, I think something that's often overlooked because game designers are kind of helicopter parents who are really worried about their game, but the benefit of leaving a group of playtesters entirely alone with your rulebook to learn it themselves, and no matter how much you want to, don't answer any of their questions. Just see how they play it and how they interpret what's written down can be incredibly valuable to make sure that it's understandable. And it's not, but also remembering that people who are at a playtest convention, not to be rude, they're trapped playing your game, whether they want to or not. They've signed up for it, they're here, they're in front of you, they don't want to, you know, be rude. So their experience reading through your rule book and kind of having already agreed to sit down and play is not necessarily what a total stranger who doesn't have to play your game if they don't want to is going to experience when they take your rule book out. So you want to make sure it matches your audience. Someone who loves 4X games, buying a new 4X game and taking out a huge manual rule book, they're like, ah, this is gonna be my Sunday, I'm gonna read the whole thing. But if you're designing for a kid's game, who's going to be taking that rule book out? It's probably a very tired parent, and they don't want to read more than, you know, two pages. And if it's that long, they might go, oh my God, and give up. So making sure that your rule book, it's clear, it explains everything, but sometimes cutting down the stuff you include in the rules. Don't have as many examples, don't have as many appendices with, you know, what special interactions between certain things are, just to make the document seem less intimidating. Because people won't realize if three pages at the end are entirely reference. They'll just see a 10-page rule book.
Okay. Yeah, just one last thing, and then we got to move.
Yes.
We're already halfway through.
Oh, no.
Number 7, your presentation is too long. Just one last thing about rules, because I think the blind playtesting, so that's blind playtesting is when you don't actually teach the rules. And it's really, really hard to do because very rarely, even if you're like hovering over somebody, you influence stuff. I know that, so Rob Davio and Matt Leacock, when they did Pandemic Legacy, they specifically made up like 10 sets and they sent them to people, and with very explicit instructions that you must set up your a camcorder or your phone or something. You have to film yourself playing the entire game. Because even if you just send it to somebody and they play it and they send you a report, you don't even really know if they're playing it by the right rules. So
yeah,
so
sometimes you'll get playtest your feedback and
they got it
say,
back and they could see where people
this
were stumbling.
This is too strong.
They
you don't know if they did it right.
They would see if they're playing it right and things like that. So just a technique that you can use.
Yeah. Okay. Now, rule number 7, game audience mismatch. So this is especially important coming from a publisher standpoint, as someone who thinks less about the artistry of game design and more about selling them and making money off of them. Similarly to how I was talking to you about game length, people will see certain types of games and think, oh, this game is for me or this game is not for me, based on the length, the cover design, the art style, the theme, stuff like that. And sometimes people will pitch me games that are super light, super family friendly in terms of theme. You know, they'll be like, this is a game about being a puppy who's frolicking through a field. And then we'll get into it and they'll be like, it's an intensive, like, betting game. And I'm like, I don't know if that's what puppy frolicking through the field audiences want, is a 7-hour like miniatures game. So you have to make sure that you know not only what you want your game to achieve, but who you think would pick it up and play it, and make sure it's fun for them. Is it simple enough if you're making a game with a theme that appeals to kids? Is it like hardcore enough if it's dark and grungy, you know, then do you feel like you have mechanics that bring that out? It's not too abstracted. You want your players to feel like they're in it. So I guess the sort of thing here is, have you thought about who's going to buy your game and what they want from your game in order to buy it?
Yeah. And we touched base on that with Space Cadets. And that is the artwork, too, right? If you've got light, fluffy artwork, right, it's you don't want to have a super crunchy game. And that was one of the issues with Space Cadets, was that the promise did not match the delivery. So.
Oh, we can skip this one. We just did that.
Oh, you ended with a whimper.
Yeah.
I'll do
go
this
for
one.
It.
Okay, so studies, many of which have involved colonoscopies, have shown that, in general, the way we remember something, if we think back on it, is we basically average the peak experience, whether it's a high or a low, with the ending experience. All the stuff that happens in between that doesn't matter. The length even doesn't matter to a certain extent when you're thinking back on something, unless the length, kind of really negatively impacted it. But it's the average of the peak and the end. So the way that that's going to be the best is if you end very strongly. And I see a lot of games that they just kind of
peter out
at the end. So you want to try to avoid that. And going back to both Dice Duel and Space Cadets, so I mean, Dice Duel to a certain extent, so
Dice Duel is a game we designed together. It's also Spaceship, that's why it's in the Space Cadets universe. It's a team on team speed game, sort of real-time speed game, dice rolling. So one team is one spaceship, the other team's the other spaceship. You're fighting against each other. You're rolling dice to arm your torpedoes and move around. And every time you launch a torpedo at the enemy ship, that's the only time that the real time stops. And you'll resolve whether or not you hit or not. So you'll be like rolling, and go like, fire! Which I'm not going to yell into the mic because we get in trouble for doing that in crowded buildings. And then everything will stop. Everyone will put their dice down. You'll say, okay, we have a full torpedo and you're four spaces away from us. So we had to have this kind of sensor lock on you to have the range. Let's see what side of the ship it would hit. Are your shields there? No. Okay, we hit you and we won. That's not the last moment you want. You don't want it to be math and slow sort of decision making. It's the kind of the worst part of the game is stopping to figure out if you hit or not.
Yeah.
And that necessarily, because that's when the other ship blows up, is what our ending was. So it's a bit of a bummer. It's not growing into sort of a frenzied high, and then...
Right. Well, sometimes you do have a stand-up die roll, depending on what it is. If you get
that's true. Sometimes you have and to roll works. A die, and so that's
and,
helpful.
And I still was very, you know, it was very well received, and I still love it. And so, I mean, it's not
my
like
favorite
that
game.
Killed the game, but but the point is it didn't... we could have amplified that more somehow at the end so that it worked. Space Cadets actually had this issue in design. So again, that's the cooperative game, and you had your whole ship, and so, you know, we had like this big damage display, and basically if the enemy hit your core, your ship blew up and you lost. And it just, again, it was the same thing. You rolled some dice, you checked the chart, and you just lost. And even winning to a certain extent, you accomplished the mission and you just won. And some, you know, depending on the mission, sometimes it was exciting, but a lot of times it wasn't. So we went back to the drawing board and we're like, we've got to deal with this. So we actually added two mini games for both winning and losing. We wanted losing, even if you lose, to be exciting. So winning, we ended up putting this jump mechanic in. So every mission, even when you accomplish the goals, you still have to jump out of the sector to win the game. So during the game, you can earn different bonuses and things in the jump mini game. But ultimately, when you're ready to jump, you have to roll Yahtzee. And by earning certain bonuses...
Pushing.
What was that?
I thought it was the stacked cubes.
No, we got rid of that.
We got rid of that? Oh, man, I haven't played this game in too long.
Yeah.
Go on.
You got to roll Yahtzee, and you can earn bonuses that let you manipulate the dice in 30 seconds. So basically, you can get rerolls, you can turn dice over, you can add. So, but you've got 30 seconds to run through all this and figure out how to turn your dice, your initial roll, into five of a kind. And the whole team's clustered around, everyone's screaming. So even when you do it, it's exciting. And if you don't do it, you even if you fail, you earn another bonus for the next time you jump. And on the negative side, if your core is hit, we added something called a core breach. You don't actually blow up, but it triggers another mini game, which is basically everybody in the crew gets a shape card. A number of shape cards are passed out. It goes higher and higher and higher, so you got to do more. And there's another deck that has those same shapes in it. And while you're doing your regular job, like loading the torpedoes or setting up the shields in that 30 seconds, you also have to pass this deck of shapes around. You've got to find the one that matches one you have and then pass the deck to the next person. If you don't find all the shapes in the 30 seconds, then your ship blows up, right? But if you do, then the core breach is sealed and you're fine. And so you just go on, and the next time you get a core breach, it goes up by one. You got one more shape you got to find.
Hypothetically, you could never lose if you do it well enough, which means you're always in this frantic pace of, we can hold on one more turn, we can make it.
Right.
And you sort of have that feeling of, we really need to do it right now in this 30-second window, or
right.
else it's game over,
right.
rather
but
than
some
the game
people
over
are like,
being
you
determined.
Know, oh, no, I got to get these shields up before I fix a core breach. And everyone else is like, no!
No! Reaches more important. But
so
yeah.
it's one of the mechanics I'm most proud of that I've ever done, because it's just, it's even what people love losing, right, in a co-op game, and it's, you know, it's like a magic trick, and so it just works really well.
On a sort of quick extension to the point, not only is it important to end very cool, but I think a lot of people disregard sort of a narrative arc to your game, and that doesn't mean necessarily a story, but the players should feel like there is growth and change over the course of the game. They become more powerful or more adept at accomplishing the things the game asks them to accomplish, up to the point where they finally succeed. And a lot of games, they'll have multiple sort of rounds I've seen, but each of the rounds, you're equally powerful as you were in all the other rounds, or you're equally likely to draw good cards. And so you don't have that feeling of progression, that sort of narrative arc that makes a game feel really satisfying and memorable. Like, oh man, I ended with these things. If you, you know, just kind of lucked into them, it's not as meaningful as if you built it up over the course of the game yourself, too.
Okay.
Sorry.
No,
go.
That's fine. We're halfway through.
Oh, okay. Number four. Back on making money. I have gotten a lot of submissions from people with super cool games that I have no idea how we would produce. People will 3D print their own pieces, fancy dice towers. I've seen games where the entire board is a cube that rotates and you have pieces that stick onto it. And I'm like, that's awesome. It's gonna be an $150 product for a game that takes like 30 minutes to play. It's just not feasible to be mass produced. So this is more a concern maybe for for later on in your project, but take a look at the quantity of pieces, the specialty pieces you have. What does your game need? How expensive is it going to be to produce versus what price point do you think people would pay for the experience that your game delivers in terms of length, complexity, fanciness? If you have a game that plays in 20 minutes, great. We wanted it to be short, it's sweet. People are probably not going to pay more than, you know, $25 for a game that's that fast. So probably it's in a small.
The slide that's up there, this Nova League. So
yeah.
That's a 20-minute game that is going to cost about $80.
Yeah. It's played
so
on those vibrating football
tables. Vibrating
electric
football. There you go. So this is a new version of vibrating electric football with special characters and stuff like that. And we've been having a lot of trouble. It's a whole long story. But just in terms of publishing it, we're partnered with the original company now that makes electric football. So they know how to make the board. But just making the vibrating board was very challenging and turned a lot of companies off the whole thing because they didn't know how to do it.
Okay, let's keep going. You get it.
Okay. So a lot of people are, you know, a lot of people talk about replayability. This is relating to replayability. And a lot of people are very concerned about that and how is it going to work? How is it going to be replayable? And I've seen a number of games that are way more concerned about replayability than they are about making the core game really, really good and deep, right? You don't need variability to make replayability necessarily. I mean, look at chess or Go or bridge or poker or whatever, right? I mean, you know, there's, I guess, card shuffles are all a little bit different, but there's ways to do it without having... You know, Cosmic Encounter kind of ruined us in that there's, you know, 87 different special characters that you can have and stuff like that.
If your game is really strong, it will inspire in players to think, I should have tried a different strategy, I should have made different choices, and that's the replayability they bring themselves. I played a game here, playtested a prototype, it was just everyone had 6 cards, identical amongst everyone, so there was absolutely no difference among the players, and as soon as it was done, I was like, oh man, I want to play that immediately again, because, you know, the choices were so tight to the kind of meaning of your decisions. I didn't need a different player power. I didn't need to be presented with a whole different set of choices because I wanted to play that game again. I wanted to, you know, improve on my own experience in the game and my own decisions. And that's not to say that having variable player powers and stuff is a bad thing to add to a game, but making sure that the most important thing is that your game itself, the core concept of it, is strong, and it's not strong just because there's 17 different ways to play or different game modes, or you're selling a pack of cards that can be played 10 different games. Are any of those games the one you've really put your time and focus into? You should make that one really
right.
Great.
It should be the cherry on top. I'm so excited to find out what's going to come next.
Yeah, we don't know our own
We practice this so much. I'm sure you can all tell.
Number two. Too much innovation. So I'm sure as seasoned gamers, you know that most games that come out can be compared to other games. Oh, it's kind of like Codenames, but with this. So it's a lot like, you know, a new kind of worker placement. And a lot of people think, oh, I don't want my game to be like all the other games that are out there. My game is brand new. I've come up with something totally original that no one's ever thought of before. And sometimes that can be a trap because consumers actually are more drawn to things they are somewhat familiar with that they can couch in an understanding of, oh, this is like that other game I like, so I will probably like this. A game that's not like anything anyone's played before can sometimes just fail to land because it doesn't have an established audience. Most people actually want to see games that are new riffs on things they think they understand. A new way to do worker placement, a new way to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I like to compare this to other media in terms of games, right? Particularly as games mature as an industry. You know, think about movies, right? I mean, if you go to see a rom-com, I don't want to see the new innovative rom-com. You know, I know what rom-com is going to be. I want to see those story beats. you know, most movies are just taking existing elements, existing types of shots, existing types of plot structures, existing types of genres, and remixing them in interesting ways. And I think there's plenty of room for that. Now, the other thing is, if you want to be innovative, which is great, that's fine, but, you know, I think realistically, you want to limit yourself to one innovation in your game. I've seen games where there's like two or three really cool ideas, but because there's so many different things, it's just hard to wrap your head around what it is. I mean, as an example, think about Dominion, right? When Dominion came out, Dominion is really takes, it's very much just deck building distilled down to its purest form, right? So after that, there's been a ton of other deck building games that have layered on top of that. But like if, you know, I don't know, Thunderstone or whatever, if one of the more advanced deck builder games was the first deck builder, if Dominion had tried to put that in there, I don't think it would have been as popular. I don't think it would have caught on as much. I mean, obviously it's a counterfactual that you can't, who knows, but I mean, just in general, the purity of Dominion and the very focus on that one idea that it had
people
was,
need
I think,
something,
its core strength.
People need something to hold on to. They need to have a footing in your game. And if you're presenting them with only things they don't know what they are, then they won't really know how to proceed, what kind of strategies to take for that first play experience. It also plays a little bit into game audience mismatch. Taking the rom-com example, if you say, hey, this is a rom-com, people want, who go to see the rom-com want to see a rom-com. If you're like, this is an innovative rom-com because all the characters are murdered by an evil clown, then all the people who love evil clown movies won't have seen it because you told them it was a rom-com, and all the people who love rom-coms will be like, this is the worst rom-com ever. So, you know, you don't want to remake a movie that's already been out, but making sure that your audience feels like they go to it because they know what's going to be there somewhat and they want to be pleasantly surprised with the new version you've created.
Right.
And
Did we take out there's no reason for your game to exist?
No, I think that's number one.
Okay. Because that's exactly counter to this.
Number one! There's no reason for your game to exist. I wanted to put these two back to back because I think they're simultaneously true, even though they're opposites. That we just talked a big game about how you don't want to go too far out of the lines, but at the same time, we're experiencing a boom in the number of board games that are hitting the market, and you need to make sure there's a reason your game is different than all the other games. There's a reason your game is going to get played when people have thousands of games on their shelves.
There's 4,000 to 5,000 new board games, just board games, published every year, okay? So when you go, if you're pitching to a publisher, I mean, it's a little bit different if you're self-publishing, but if you're pitching to a publisher, people ask me for advice, they're like pitching, or I'll read their pitch or whatever, and the number one thing you need to bring to a publisher, and she will expound on this more eloquently than I, but the number one thing is, how am I going to make money on this game? How am I going to sell this game? And the hook could be in innovation. The hook could be, you know, cute little dragons. The hook could be, it's got, you know, holographic cards. It's got a giant 3D dice tower that you construct, whatever. But there's got to be some hook.
Yeah, people come to me because I do acquisitions, so I'll be pitched games, and people will pitch me a couple games rapid fire. I'll say, oh, none of those are for our company, and they'll go, okay, so what are you looking for? And unfortunately, aside from the list of no's, just because they're not in our company portfolio, you know, we don't make this kind of game, that kind of game, this length of game, when people say, what are you looking for, all I can say is something unique. It's sort of a je ne sais quoi, you'll know it when you see it. It has to have a selling point that no other game on the market has right now. It's doing something that people want that isn't, they can't get anywhere else. Because a lot of games, you know, they'll be new, they'll be different, but I'll say, why would I be playing this when I could be playing this other game that already exists that's doing the similar concept stronger? Or even if it's not doing a similar concept stronger, it's not, this one is not strong enough or different enough to break through the market where people are already, you know, like, you know, Pandemic or whatever is so ubiquitous now. A game that's just like Pandemic but a teeny bit different might not find an audience because that audience is already satisfied by having Pandemic, and there's so many Pandemic like expansions and stuff. So that's not a market to go into. There's no one out there who wants that game because they're satisfied already. So definitely both in your game design and in pitching if you want to bring it to a publisher, going front and center, not with the core of your game. Don't say, hey, I have this game, and it's a worker placement game, even if that's the core of it. Only go forward right away with the thing that makes it different than other games, you know? It's a worker placement game where your workers fly around all these different places, you know? Okay, I haven't seen that before, perhaps. That's what, you know, and you get like one or two sentences to sell it to a publisher. You need to make sure that what makes it super unique, what's gonna make it sell, what's gonna make it different, is front and center.
Yeah. And so just a couple of examples. First off, the game that's up here, this is the only game that we did not make. The reason I put that up there is because I come up with a quantum mechanics particle physics game, and this game kind of, you know, sucked the air out of that. That was really the only thing that was different about it, really, was the fact that it was about particle physics. So I didn't think the world needed two particle physics games, and so I kind of shelved it. So like I said, it could be thematic. I mean, like, for just some examples of some pitches, like I talked about the pinball game, right? I mean, the pitch was it's a roll and write that makes you feel like you're playing pinball. That was the pitch. And from pinball, you can do lots of different expansions. You can do different things. Like Super Disco Pinball, we've had four different expansions after it. Each one comes with four different pinball tables because it's, you know, it's pinball and that's what people expect. I just recently did another pitch to a major publishing company that got picked up. We're working on it now. I can't talk about the details, but the pitch in that one was sort of a mechanical system pick. It's also a roll and write, but the idea was that it's a way that you can. It's a little bit of a different twist on a roll and write, and it's not just for this game, but you could set up a whole system of games. And here's other IPs that you're in that you could apply this to, and that was very attractive to them. So there just needs to be some kind of a hook on something, on what it is.
But yeah, looks like it's 11 because everyone is leaving.
It's 7 of 11.
7 of 11. So we should probably ask any questions while we're here.
Yes.
Yes. What is number, say again?
10.
Oh, what was the first one? Your game is too long.
No. Number 10 was your game is too much.
Oh, too much going on.
Too much going
too
on.
Too many elements.
Yeah. So the idea was that you've thrown every idea that you've got. You haven't focused down your idea to actually what the game really wants to be about.
And I will say we had someone come in earlier and say that these are being recorded and are going to be put online. So if you missed the beginning of the talk, you can check that out.
Number 9 was your game is too long.
There we go.
Okay. Other questions? Comments? Any of this ring true to people, or?
Or do you want to tell us how dare you?
The things you've already said are pretty much spot on. Like what everybody, you know, even like because I went to film school, so a lot of what you basically have said is basically what applies to film school. And so it's very much
interesting.
Now we are mentioning like what you're basically saying because I've heard like the horror rom com movie, like what you're talking like this is a rom-com twisted upside down, it's more of a horror rom-com, you know, that's what people like, okay, that's interesting enough, like, what's the premise, and then we're kind of like more intrigued by it. So if you combine two things, but you have to know how to use it.
I think that combining two things is one of the most successful ways for games to be. Usually, it's harder to make a twist on one mechanic because that mechanic is so sort of solid. But saying like, oh, this mechanic from this game and this mechanic from this game, what if they were in the same game? My most popular game I've ever designed is called Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition. We wanted to make Terraforming Mars faster, easier to play, more accessible. So we took Terraforming Mars, we took Race for the Galaxy, we basically mashed them together. Our very first playtest was literally the like day we thought of it. We just took the phase cards out of Race for the Galaxy, took out all the Terraforming Mars cards that didn't make sense with like the most basic framework, and we just played that. Absolutely no innovation, absolutely no like writing on anything, just to see if it would work because that's something new, even if it's something familiar. It's something that hadn't existed, but it is made up of things that do exist.
Yeah, I mean, we were playtesting a game last night, and I'm throwing this idea out for free, although, you know.
No, we were going to do it.
We're going to do it, but I'm going to throw it out. But just as an example, we were just playtesting a game last night, and Sydney just later said, you know, kind of riffing on it, was like, you know what would really be cool, which is not what this game was. it was a zombie game. But what would really be cool is if you were playing Clue, but the mansion, zombies. While you're trying to solve the crime, you're being attacked by zombies.
Clue with zombies.
And I'm like, that's actually pretty cool. That could be fun. You know, you're in the ballroom, but you're trying to find the clue in the ballroom. But meanwhile, the zombies are all banging on the door and you're trying, you know, you're under time pressure from that to do it. That could be fun, you know. So
yeah, so it doesn't have to be, you know, I mean, I think the
right.
You don't have to be too innovative yeah. slide was about the fact it doesn't have to be something no right. one's thought of before.
I mean, if you went to a publisher and said, we want to make Clue with zombies, they would kind of get that, and they could maybe picture mm-hmm. in their mind how they might market that. So I don't know. Maybe it'll be a disaster. We'll see.
Oh, I hope it'll be a disaster. Then we'll have an extra slide. Any other questions?
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you for your time
you
and
so
attention and Power Brick particularly. Thank you very
yes.
much. You saved our day. Enjoy the rest of your convention.
Woo! All that not practicing.